Hey, this is Craig Custance of The Athletic, joined, as always, on Tuesday on the Americans edition of The Athletic Hockey Podcast by Sean Gentile. And boy, do we have... We are now revved up for the offseason. It's no longer hypothetical, Sean. We've got trade requests. We have actual trades. We have... There's so much in a draft. We've got... I'm excited. This is the best. Best time of year.
I don't think the offseason actually starts until I gin up some opinions on draft guys. Like, I've only gotten there in the last couple of weeks. So I'm like, all right, I think I know what I'm talking about. And the main reason I'm there, obviously, is because of guys like our guest, Scott Wheeler. Mm-hmm. He keeps all of us plebes who don't have time to... Or don't have the inclination to watch tape on all these guys.
Inclination. Boy, do I want to not watch any tape on these people I'm going to follow those on.
Yeah, right. Any shortcuts I can take, any opportunities to not do my job, I'm all for. And man, Wheels provides that for us, right?
Yeah, we've got Scott Wheeler coming up with a conversation. It was awesome. We've already recorded it, and I can, it's really good, and it's worth your time. So now I wasn't going to go here right away, but you got it. What's your strongest draft opinion? What's Sean Gentile's like player that he loves, even though you haven't either watched any of these guys and you're basing it only on your reading of Corey Pronman, who's dead to us, and Scott Wheeler, who's the best
Corey Pronman, who is dead to us and will remain dead to us as our chief rival on the
I've fallen in love with William on the Friday show. That's my.
I mean, we're going back to what we talked about last week, right? Where it's like Eklund's great, and the scouting reports for Kent Johnson just fascinate me because he's like not that great of a skater, but he's super skilled and the ceiling's high, but the floor is pretty low too. Like I'm all ready for it, man. Let's go.
Yeah. Again, I've never seen William Eklund play.
No.
5 seconds.
I wouldn't even know him. He could walk into this room and say, "Hey, I'm William Eklund," and I'd be like, "All right."
Somebody we do know well that we've been covering a long time though is Duncan Keith, and I know the trade went down yesterday. So the way the internet works and Twitter, we by this time this drops, we will all have moved on to the next thing. But I do want to talk a bit because I'm seeing a lot of hand wringing coming from Edmonton and. Boy, did the Oilers screw up here. That there's terrible cap management, etc. Not saying any of that's invalid. I think that the majority of the noise seems to be coming from Edmonton. It's our job to give the American perspective. The Chicago Blackhawks traded one of the most important players in franchise history, Sean. And it was like, time to move on, I guess.
I feel like every week we end up talking about something that Lazarus wrote, right? Yeah. Like we end up having Mark Lazarus Corner where we spend 5 minutes talking about, his latest bit. But I thought he nailed it with Duncan Keith because that was my reaction too. I mean, I think part of it was the nature of the trade where it happened in slow motion over the course of 5 days. So maybe the fan base or whatever sort of resigned themselves to the fact that it happened or that it would happen. Part of it was the way Keith played last year. He stunk. Like that's just brass tacks on it. So I think maybe people were ready for, that kind of split to take place. He turns 38 in a couple days, on and on. There's reasons where it seemed like it was a soft exit for Keith out of Chicago. But man, to see it in practice yesterday was wild because this is 2-time Norris winner, had all of his teeth knocked out, the best defenseman on, maybe this, we'll say the second best team of this era. And it was like
Michigan State, okay. Spartan, of course.
Whatever. but it was like okay, like he's gone, like that's it. What's next? Which is just wild to me. And I think what Laz hit on too is that this is like, obviously Kane and Taves are still there, but you're talking about a core of 7 players and then Joel Quenneville that have just steadily over the last few years made their exit. So I guess it's just that the Blackhawks fans and Chicago and whatever else were just they watch Marian Hossa leave, and they watch Brandon Saad get traded again, and they watch Brent Seabrook retire, and you have all these guys that have made their exit already. So it's like they're just, you know, they've already begun the bargaining process, and you know, with all this. But man, again, it's wild because Keith was, you know, for a stretch, you could argue that he was the best player on that team. Period. And, yeah. and his exit was pretty unceremonious.
And there was also a stretch where it's funny how everything has changed, where Duncan Keith's contract was the best in hockey, mm-hmm. the best, where, you know, he was playing because he had one of those long-term deals. He was playing at half price, and everybody, like the Blackhawks, by the way, were the first Lightning where everybody was mad about their cap management. Like, they squeezed Patrick Kane in the playoffs, like all the stuff that the Lightning are doing now is you know, nothing new, right? Under the sun. And You had Duncan Keith, who people were just livid because it was a cheater contract. Marian Hossa, cheater contract. You know, not me saying that. That was, and now, you know, now it's like, oh, terrible contract. And it's one thing. Like, I saw a tweet from somebody yesterday that was like, "Hey, everybody, can we stop bailing out the Blackhawks?" Like, the one thing this is a really tough contract to move. They get anything in return for it is interesting. And now they've got flexibility.
Stashing Hossa. Seabrook retiring.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can go down the list of ways that they have been bailed out. Seems harsh, I guess, but it's true. Right. It's true. They're setting themselves up. I mean, no money retained in sending Keith out, which is obviously the bit that Oilers fans are more livid about than anything else, right? He's you know, yes, his salary goes down. I think that's a big part of it. He's at 2.1 this year and 1.5 the year after. Still has the 5.5 and change hit. So whatever. Yeah. But man, it's another. Yeah, it is. It's wild. It's another example of that team setting themselves up for what comes next. And I think everybody was prepped for the pain to last a little bit longer than it seems like it's going to. And yeah. Like, they're like, last season was weird, and they're in a kind of an odd, you know, no man's land with Taves for plenty of reasons and Kane. But the flexibility that they've gotten with the way this has ended, whether it's Hossa, Keith, you go back, like, it's, they're going to have a shot at building it back up. I think a little bit sooner than people may have anticipated 5 years ago, let's say.
This would almost be like Chris Letang getting traded in Pittsburgh, and had been rumored for so long, and everyone just being like, oh, it finally happened, and what's for lunch?
I didn't want to bring that up because I'm like mindful of talking about that. I'm based in Pittsburgh, like whatever.
Oh, you are?
I don't know if you know this about me. Yeah. It doesn't come up that often.
Yeah.
I definitely didn't ask Scott on the spot for his best PA prospect. But I know, that's what I was thinking of yesterday. Yeah. Is like, is this what it's going to look like whenever Chris Letang, who's the obvious analog for the Penguins, the other dominant team of the last 15 years, is this what it's going to look like when he leaves town? And Chris Letang is a lightning rod. I think he's been weirdly underappreciated by a huge chunk of the fan base for a lot of reasons that we don't need to get into here. But I can guarantee you that if and when it ends for Chris Letang in Pittsburgh, whether it's tomorrow or in 3 years or whenever, it is not going to look the way it looked like for Duncan Keith yesterday. We are not going to have the same conversation.
How much do you think it's because of the lawsuit and the allegations against Brad Aldrich that, you know, you can understand Blackhawks fans not wanting to go nostalgic right now?
They have a lot on their plate right now. So I get it. And I'm not knocking Blackhawks fans for not laying like rose petals at Duncan Keith's feet on his way out. Like, it makes a lot, the reaction makes sense for plenty
like that
of
overshadows
reasons.
Everything though right now. Like,
absolutely.
Like, that's the biggest story. And so it's like, I've talked to those guys. It's like, you know, how much hockey do you write? Or, you know, it's this weird balance where, like, this is the most important story, and we're going to keep reporting it. And it's timely because Scott Powers, Katie Strang, and Mark Lazarus had a story dropping today on the Blackhawks legal strategy.
Which is repulsive.
Mm-hmm.
like it just like they're fighting to keep this still under wraps as much as they possibly can, right? Like that's the upshot of it. And again, like read the story by those three. They go into it in depth, but like you know, you keep seeing drips and drabs from this, and that overhangs everything. So I think that's a gigantic part about it, and it sucks. Like it sucks for a million reasons. Somewhere down the list is that it's stopping guys from Keith, I think, from getting the kind of treatment on the way out that they should. It's a shame.
It's just this weird thing because I think that maybe that's part of why we're hearing, you know, you're not gonna like throw bouquets at Stan Bowman, right? Like for clearing cap space when his name is all over the, you know, this other
seriously
coverage.
Like, oh yeah, way to go Stan Bowman for getting a conditional second back for Duncan Keith. Like what do you do? Like you can't give him credit for that because right. because he seems to have failed in so many other much more important ways aside from winning a trade, right? So that
right.
Yeah, that's all in the air too, but it's made for a weird 24 hours here.
I thought in that coverage, you know, there was a quote from a league executive in the story today that in talking about Stan Bowman, that the quote is he's proceeding as if he's in charge and he's going to be in charge for the next X amount of years of his contract. And that's how he's conducting his business. He's conducting Blackhawks business. That hasn't changed. And you know, at some point, it'll be interesting. You know, he's going to have to go in front of the media. They're going to make a draft pick. They're going to make a trade. And like they've, again, in the story, they talk, the Blackhawks have gone into bunker mode. When you're, you know, one of the faces of the franchise and your job is to discuss with the media, you can't exist in bunker mode.
He can put his head down and he can try to whistle through the graveyard for the time being, but he's not going to be able to do that forever. And we're coming up to the draft and we're coming up to, you know, this weird little post-cup lull that we have in the schedule is going to end. And he's going to have to answer for stuff. So he can focus now on trying to win trades and squeeze a second conditional out of the Oilers rather than just a third and whatever, but not going to be able to do it forever.
Yeah. You're right in how that trade, and maybe this is happening again with Eichel and Tarasenko. Like it does seem like it happened in slow motion is a really good way to put it. And you know, so raises the question is what's the next one on the docket?
How many times have we seen the time frames change on Eichel and now Tarasenko? Like we are. Yeah. 6 weeks ago or a month ago, we're like, watch out, Eichel could get traded during the playoffs. And it's like, well, now it might not happen till after the expansion draft again. It's anticlimactic, yeah. I think, if nothing else.
Well, I think part of it is, you know, if you're acquiring players for Eichel or you're sending them the other way, like this, that complicates all the work that teams have put into their expansion draft protected list. So now you've got to add more players to the list. Even you saw some of that with the Duncan Key thing. Now, you know, what do they do with some of the players they still have to sign? And there's all these complicating factors. So that's why I think we have to get through the expansion draft before. And then I think there's just going to be this flurry of activity.
9 out of 10 moves should wait until after the expansion draft. There's some stuff you could do if you're a team who needs to make moves to set up your protect list the way that you want. Those moves exist, but for the most part, you'll be much better served waiting. Which is why the initial, you know, a few weeks ago, where it's like, well, you could get maybe we will get this, but before the expansion draft, the logical question when you hear that is like, is why? Why would we? Why would the Sabres move Jack Eichel now versus in, you know, 19 days or whatever?
I thought another name that was thrown in the mix today, and his name has kind of been out there kicked around as a trade option, was Rick Carpinello had a story and Pavel Buchnevich. I think part of it is he's got a contract coming up. Carpi spoke with his agent, Todd Diamond, who said, you know, they expect to have some conversations and that the Rangers will qualify him. But you also have an organization there that's loaded with good young forwards, specifically on the wing. And, you know, if you're trying to make an upgrade or, you know, Carpi even floated this, Tarasenko, maybe this is where you build a Tarasenko deal around. Can you imagine a Rangers team with the talent they have? Panarin and Tarasenko? I mean,
what percentage would Tarasenko need to come back for you for it to be worth it? Because everyone's concerned because he's had two serious shoulder surgeries and there might not be a third based on what we've heard. Like he's on the razor's edge with this. So like whatever, you're not getting the tank from 5 years ago probably, but still a pretty good player. If you get like 75% Tarasenko, like is that good enough to make the Godfather offer? And again, we have a package from Jeremy Rutherford that's like in a bunch of other writers that are sort of trying to, you know, postulate what a Tarasenko deal would look like, and they're asking for a lot, as is understandable.
They are, but I mean, you're right. This isn't Tarasenko from 5 years ago. Like this is heavy mileage, playoff runs. You know, he's a tank for sure. But it was only one line in Carpi's story. I think the Rangers, it makes almost no sense to me. What giant hole are you filling by bringing him in? And then you've got young players you're going to have to sign. Like,
it's cap space is a thing. It's here. A cap. Well, because like you're moving a certain kind of problem for another certain kind of problem, where it's like we have too many wingers. We're going to have to pay them at some point. So you go out and you move one of those wingers for another winger that eats up cap space and kind of stops you from setting your salary structure for the next however many years. I mean, would it be fun? Like, absolutely. Everyone loved Tarasenko and, you know, Panarin and whatever. Everybody, I think on some level, it would be fun to watch the Rangers go all in. I think it's
I'm on board with it. I'm not saying
totally,
it would be fun.
Totally. It's fun in general to watch teams go all in. Everyone's you're the Kings, trade Quinton, trade Turcotte for Jack Eichel, like whatever. We're all rooting for that on some level just because it's a great story. But from a hockey standpoint, like as juicy as it is, I don't think it makes a ton of sense.
All right. So Jeremy Rutherford reports in his story. So Tarasenko has a list with as many as 10 teams in which he'd approve a deal. JR speculates that there's five that makes sense in terms of what he's hearing that Tarasenko would accept: the Rangers, the Islanders, the Golden Knights, the Bruins, and the Flyers. Is there a team in that group that it makes? So we'll remove the Rangers from the equation. I don't think it makes a ton of sense, even though I'm sure Tarasenko would love to go to New York. Is there a team in that group where you're like, that? I like that. I think that's the fit.
I love him on the Islanders, dude.
I like that.
Love it.
Do you?
Love it. Yeah. I'm always for the Islanders trying to add offensive pieces. You know, like I think that was what we talked about, you know, in the run up to the deadline with them, because, you know, they lose Anders Lee and blah blah, right? So everyone's like, oh, go out and get Kyle Palmieri. It happens. Basically worked.
Yeah.
Delayed.
It worked. Basically, you don't have to modify it.
It was a time release on it, like where it looked like it was gonna backfire a bit, like in the regular season. But all's well that ends well. Like he looked great there. I love the idea of the Islanders taking a swing. Mm-hmm. And they have, you know, JR and Corey talk about this too. I think Noah Dobson is the name there, just because they are fairly stacked along the blue line, so they would be dealing from a position of strength. And mm-hmm. we have seen Lou, like with the Palmieri deal, like he'll spend to the cap. He doesn't care. There's no governor there. Like if he wants a guy, he's obviously got carte blanche to go get him. I think that'd be fun.
I like that. I'm with you. I'll go with the Islanders as the fit I would like to see. And Lou has a history of going out and getting Russians, and he's, you know what I mean? Like that's part of
Russian players love New York. I know, Nassau County or wherever those guys would live isn't quite the same as, you know, Brighton Beach or whatever. But man, it's a fit for a lot of reasons.
I think we should adopt the Islanders in the show as the American. I love it. Like the American team that nobody covers really. Besides Arthur Staple. I mean, at a national level, they always get disrespected, and here they've done is gone to two straight conference finals. have the best coach in the game in Barry Trotz, maybe. John Cooper probably would have something to say about that. But Lou Lamoriello, I mean, come on. That should be like the unofficial official team of this podcast.
They were one game from winning a Stanley Cup.
Yeah.
You know,
in retrospect,
they'd have beat Montreal.
They would have beat. You're right. And it was a 1-0 game. Like in seeing what Tampa did to Montreal and just dismantling the Canadiens, just, you know, systematically there. Like
boring.
It made with the Islanders.
A boring series, by the way.
Like,
we can say it. It was a dud. I had to do the live blog for game 4. Mm-hmm. What a slog.
Yeah.
I very rarely feel that way about Cup Finals games. I'm like, ah, Christ, I gotta watch this now.
So they're two goals away from winning a Stanley Cup this mm-hmm. year. If they could have won 2-1 in game 7 instead of 1-0.
Yep.
Yeah. That's
the official team of the Tuesday edition of the Athletic Hockey Show. All right, we're Islanders fans now. We're just fans. Absolutely. I'm gonna go buy my Pulock jersey now.
Oh my gosh.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
We are thrilled to be joined now by the prospect writer for The Athletic. In my opinion, pound for pound, the best prospect writer we have, way better than Corey Pronman, probably by a lot.
By quite a bit.
Yeah, like a lot. And we like Scott Wheeler so much that he's our first Canadian guest on the All-American edition of... Yeah, we made an exception
a
for you, Scott.
A privilege and an honor.
Congratulations, so buddy. Yes.
Yeah, congratulations.
The plaque is in the mail.
Yeah. We broke the seal here. Scott, I wanted to start, the timing is perfect like with this, and I want to act like we planned it, and you dropped a story today. It was our A1 offering at The Athletic, which goes to all subscribers. It's the biggest story of the day on our site every day, and you filled that slot today with your story on Malky Samoskovich, is that right?
Yep, Samoskovich.
Samoskovich. I even prepped it too and asked you. And he, it's a story of him. He's a projected first or second round pick who was part of the Sandy Hook shootings. And it's an emotional read. It's, you know, it's really, by the end of it, you're like, it's about life. It's about hockey. It's about using hockey as an escape. How did that story come together, Scott?
Well, it really just started, I mean, in research for the draft a couple of years ago, I couldn't help but notice that it was just listed in his bio as being from Newtown, Connecticut. Yeah. And then from there, it was okay doing the mental math in my head of how old would he have been? Does he have siblings and family that live in the area? That kind of a thing. And then you obviously hope and pray that none of them were impacted in any sort of fatal way, obviously. Thankfully, that wasn't a part of this story. All three of their kids had attended the school. Sandy Hook was from kindergarten through grade 4. Him and his twin sister, Maddie, were in grade 5 when it happened. So they were, it happened in December. They were really in the early stages of their life at a new school. And would have just left Sandy Hook that spring when they graduated, right? So they'd been there for 4 years. They knew the faculty. They knew the students. Some of the teachers who were lost, unfortunately, had taught them. So they were lucky that it hadn't impacted them sort of firsthand, but definitely secondhand. So then it was just, in terms of the story process, was just about reaching out to them and feeling it out, because you don't want it to be exploitative. You don't want it to be... something that it's not. If this wasn't something that impacted them in any serious way, then I didn't want to write it that way. I was happy to write a hockey story about Mackie as a prospect if that's what it was. But it did impact them in a serious way. And in particular, his father, Fred, who ended up on the scene that day and spent the entire day on the scene that day, and was sort of helping to direct traffic as things piled up, as cars and cop cars and state troopers and ambulances piled up. He would just so happen to be driving through as all of this was taking place. And him and his wife were sitting in the diner, literally almost right next to the school as all of the cop cars started racing by. So then it was really about that day and all of their experiences in that day. His older sister, Melissa, has won world championships for the United States, is a very accomplished hockey player at the pinnacle of her sport in her own way. And she was away at Shattuck that day, sort of following it on her phone and following it on Twitter and worrying about whether their school was impacted and not knowing whether their school was a part of it. And just all of that sort of wrapped up into this story about ultimately that day and their experiences that day, but then also just their town and how they came together in the aftermath and what that day has meant for their family and their new appreciation for what their family really means to them. So it wasn't just about that day, and it shouldn't have been, but they were very kind and generous to really relive it with me and walk me through it, because they absolutely did not have to do that.
Just, I'm assuming everyone listening is familiar with the story, but that's the Sandy Hook shooting is when the gunman walked in. 26 people were killed, including 20 children. And, you know, in our country, that's as many terrible incidences as there are or have been since then and continue to be, that's one that I think has stuck with a lot of people for a lot of different reasons. And clearly in reading the story, the detail in which the parents and the kids remember everything, right to, you know, sitting in the diner and what they're thinking as the police cars drive by and everything, clearly made a huge impact. And I'm wondering, did you get any sense of, you know, how they balance such a tragic event, a life-altering event with, you know, something, I don't want to say trivial as hockey, but it's like, how do you think it impacted their path in the sport?
Well, it was funny. The first time that both Patty and Fred, and funny is the wrong word, but the first time that Patty and Fred sort of took a deep breath, they were both very emotional during my conversations. Fred, the father in particular, was very, very emotional in our conversations. And the first time that they ever really lightened up and brightened up was when they started laughing about how that weekend they faced the decision on sort of really what to do. They were kind of feeling lost. The parents in particular were really grappling with it. Melissa flew home early for her Christmas break to sort of just be with her family. And they just didn't really know what to do. Did they sort of stick around and lay low in town, or did they sort of get out of town and get the kids thinking about something else? And what they ultimately ended up doing was renting ice on a rink outside of town in a nearby town and just sort of leaving town for the weekend to go stick the three kids on a hockey rink and just let them do that to escape. And the way that they talked about hockey and their connection as a family, that's really what it's been all about always for them. It's pretty unconventional, I would say, to have a family of three hockey players and two of them be girls. We hear so many stories about brothers, right? And these NHL brothers who follow in their footsteps. But really for Mackey, his idol is his big sister. And the three of them have always shared that. They have a rink in their backyard, which Fred joked with me, you don't find many hockey rinks in backyards in Connecticut. and it's hockey is just everything to them. It's always been their escape. They laughed about how they didn't have vacations growing up. They didn't go to the Caribbean or go to Disney World. Their vacations were to Philadelphia and Boston and Toronto and Edmonton every weekend for the various hockey tournaments that the three kids were in. So it was always their way of just sort of connecting, of being together, of sort of strengthening the bond that they had as a family. And then obviously the tragedy is a piece of that as well. And just what family now means to all five of them and how tight they hold each other.
He played for the Chicago Steel. He's headed to Ann Arbor to play for the University of Michigan. Mm-hmm. And you talked to a few people, Ryan Hardy, and you talked to people in the hockey community, just in terms of his skill set and what he projects. One of the quotes said something along the lines of, not a lot of holes in this kid's game. Is he first round material in your mind, or like, where do you see his story ending up on draft.
Yeah, he's one of those kids anywhere from kind of 20 to 40. So he'll be late first, early second at the latest, I would think. Absolutely one of the most gifted players in the class. I spoke to four or five of his old coaches for this story, and they all said the same thing. Like, this kid, in terms of his skating and his skill with the puck, is right up there in the sort of top 10 of this draft. A little bit of work to do on some of the rest of the stuff, but he's a legitimate high-end offensive player who is kind of that creator that Ryan Hardy and Brock Sheehan, who previously ran the Chicago program, have done such a good job of bringing into that Steel program to make it what it is. And I mean, they've got an embarrassment of riches, we know, at Michigan already, and he's just going to add to that next year.
Okay, I wanted to clumsily transition because you mentioned Ryan Hardy, and I imagine in the process of getting to, you know, do this story and many other talent players have come through this deal, Ryan Hardy has recently got hired by the Toronto Maple Leafs, pretty important role. I mean, knowing what you know about Ryan and kind of how the different thinker he is, and of course, like, it was the least surprising hire I've ever seen. Like, he just kind of fits into that mindset of what Kyle Dubas is trying to do and surround himself with people that think differently. How do you expect his impact to be in Toronto?
Well, I think it's going to be real. It's funny. I texted Ryan as soon as I heard the news that it's been a pleasure knowing him as a source and have fun in the cone of silence, right? Like, it's
see you later, Ryan.
So he's been great to me over the years. He's one of those guys. He was in that hockey expert group text feature that I've done twice, where I invite people to just sort of text with me during a game kind of thing. And he's just been wonderful. And he's one of those guys who just loves to talk as well. Like, he'll just talk and sort of break things down in nuance that I think is pretty rare among hockey people. He definitely thinks outside of the box, which is something that Kyle has made clear in Toronto is something he covets in the people that he works with and the people he surrounds himself with. They did things completely differently. He was joking with me in the days before he was hired that he was starting to make some enemies in junior hockey up in Canada because they were taking so many players out of the OHL, so many top prospects out of Canada. And even this year out of the BCHL, they brought in Jack Barr, and they tried very hard to recruit Kent Johnson and sort of pull him away from the BCHL. So they've done it differently. They've been pretty bullish about recruiting there. And I think that's where his role is going to come in handy. He's got the development aspect. He's worked with a lot of the people who already work with the Leafs. Obviously, Greg Moore was his coach with Chicago. He's worked with Daryl Belfrey and Adam Nicklaus, who also work as skills sort of development people with the Leafs. So it's becoming a little bit of a Chicago conglomerate in the Leafs sort of front office development team. But I think he'll be really good for them in two ways. One is just recruiting. The Leafs target aggressively players in Europe. We know that. They've gone after a lot of players out of the KHL in recent years. And I think they'd like to do the same in terms of recruiting out of the United States. And Ryan, through Chicago and through his time before that at the National Development Program, just knows it in and out and has the connections there. So I think that will help for the Marlies and the Growlers as they just try to continue to recruit for both of those teams, which is ultimately what he's going to be overseeing. And then the development process, he's just all about that sort of holistic, everything under one roof, top to bottom, everybody's on the same page kind of process. That's what they were in Chicago, and that's what the Leafs have tried to do through all three levels of their sort of professional organization in Toronto. So I just think he'll be a natural fit, and I'm just really happy for him as well because he's a wonderful guy.
You mentioned losing him as a source. You can just slide someone into that space. You know, I'm always amazed, whether it's you or the villain Corey Pronman, I'm just amazed at the breadth and depth of the well that you guys have to draw from people to talk to in general about these guys. Like the amount of contact that you guys have with development guys or junior coaches or, you know, college staffers or whatever is honestly it's mind-boggling to me. So how do you balance that in general, including this time of year? Because I know you guys constantly have feelers out to people across the continent to try to, you know, just add information on these players.
Well, I think we're lucky that way. There isn't the sort of jaded relationship that a lot of NHL folks have with reporters and with the media. And B, it's ultimately their job as much as it is to develop them and coach them, it's also their job to promote them, right? Like they want these kids to progress up level. So it's in their best interest, whether it's NCAA or junior or the teams in Europe, it's in their best interest to really be eager to talk to people like us. So I just think we get lucky that way versus NHL reporters. So I think just have to work a lot harder to build those connections. These folks are just a lot more amenable to it. And then the same is true, I think, of their families. You get to, and their agents, frankly, you get them before they're in the NHL. And as a result, you get them just a lot more open to wanting to share their story. They've never shared it in many cases before. So you're not asking them a question that they've been asked 15 times already, which makes it a little bit easier to go a little deeper on just sort of building that connection and building relationships with them in that way. So I just think it's the way that it's set up is that these kids and the people who surround them are just so eager to try and make it to the next level. And the people around them are so proud of what these kids in many cases have accomplished that there's a lot of tire pumping, which is, you actually have to be a little wary of, I think.
Yeah. You'll probably have to sift through some of that.
Yeah.
I mean, that was honestly my next question. Like, how do you balance your opinion as an evaluator of these players with the word of their coaches and their families and themselves whenever completely understandably their job is like you said, it is kind of to pump tires and it is to play hype men for these guys, because there is a lot at stake, whether it's for the player individually, whether it's for the staff that's been charged with their development. Like, how do you thread that needle? Because, you know, someone like me who doesn't, you know, I don't watch these guys, right? So I rely on the word of you and Corey and guys
mostly,
like that.
Mostly
Wheeler. We're fast approaching a 90-10 split on that one for sure. But
yeah, no, it's definitely difficult.
Good.
You have to be wary of everybody's position. It's the same thing when you're dealing with an agent on anybody, whether it's these kids or their NHL clients. Like, that you have to be aware of their motives and the way that they're going to talk to you about their guys and that kind of a thing. But I just trust myself on the flip side to sort of just watch these kids, put in the time, make sure that I'm balancing what I'm seeing with what I'm being told. And then NHL scouts are always a good sort of middleman, even if it's off the record, just to go to them to say, is coach or general manager X out to lunch in their belief in this player? And NHL scouts are normally pretty, they're not known to hide their feelings one way or the other, right? They're pretty blunt with their assessments of a lot of these kids. So I think just using them can help you sort of recenter to sort of find that middle ground and find that truth in terms of who these kids actually are.
Because it is tough to deal with, you know, 17-year-olds or 18-year-olds. There's a level of, you know, what do I care if a 28-year-old NHL player is good or bad? Like, they're a professional, they're paid as such. Like, there's less of a personal connection there when you stack it up next to you, who's talking to these kids, you know, brothers and sisters and mothers or fathers. So just the ability to balance like your own personal relationships with these families, which is on a level that NHL reporters just don't get. It's wild and it's impressive.
Yeah, there's definitely the odd kid too where you honestly find yourself rooting for them.
Yeah,
I've been pretty upfront about that. Like, I think Marco Rossi in particular, he's a kid who I've developed a really strong relationship with over the years, and I just think he's a wonderful kid. I would really like, after all that he's been through, to see him succeed. I did a story last year on Zade Wisdom, same kind of thing. Like, I still text with his mom and keep in touch with her, and I'm just generally rooting for him. And so you have to be wary of that, because I think that can, if you let that shade your evaluations of the kid, then you start to lose a little credibility that way. But it's hard at times to sort of divorce yourself from the reality of also sort of wanting some of these kids who you have developed a closer relationship with to succeed.
I think people appreciate that, though, to some extent. I think that comes through with readers, especially when you're honest about it. And you're like, hey, like, Zade Wisdom, he's like, I'm rooting for him.
Yeah.
Marco Rossi, like, I'm rooting for him. I think that helps, you know, your work connect with readers on a pretty real level when they know that that's the angle that you're coming from.
And honestly, when a kid is able to build a relationship with a reporter and have you feel like it's a genuine connection, I think that also says something about just who they are as a person, because a lot of these kids, they're that sort of, I hate to say it, but they're hockey players, right? There's a bravado about them when you talk to them. They say all of the right things. They all have the exact same answers to the same kinds of questions. So the kids who aren't like that, it's not a hockey skill. It's not some translatable hockey skill that they're showing you, but I think they are showing you something about who they are, their maturity level, how they handle themselves. You can tell when a kid is genuinely interested in a conversation and that kind of a thing. And there are just so many kids who aren't.
Scott, I want you. We touched a little on the USHL. We mentioned the University of Michigan. I'm curious. I mean, we already know that the USHL is the best junior league in terms of talent in the world. huge gap over anything coming from Canada.
90-10 yet again.
90-10 again.
That's right. The Prom and Wheeler gap.
But this year's especially interesting because obviously, you know, college hockey players had an advantage of just being able to get on the ice, and USHL played. And there's how do you see that impacting this draft, like just in terms of reps and exposure?
Oh, well, it's definitely real. I mean, the Q played the closest to kind of a regular equivalent schedule to the USHL. But the WHL kids got anywhere from kind of 15 to 20 games. And obviously the OHL kids, unless they went elsewhere, got nothing. So it was a big deal that the USHL played through it. And that came with some stories that, frankly, haven't probably come to light as much as they should have in terms of COVID and the number of kids in the USHL and families over Thanksgiving, et cetera, who contracted it. So there was a price that came with USHL putting on its season in the way that they did. But the USHL played a full year, and it's going to be a huge benefit to the kids that played there in terms of their draft stock. There's no question. I talk to scouts all the time, and they say, we're evaluating these kids on equal footing, yada, yada, yada. But at the end of the day, are you going to take the kid who played 60 games this year, or are you going to take the kid who you haven't seen play since he was 16 years old, right? Like, it's just, it's a no-brainer. So I think the top prospects out of the OHL, they all got to play somewhere, and they're all going to be picked as first or second rounders regardless. They all played in Switzerland or Slovakia. But the kids who were in Canada hoping to get drafted in rounds 4, 5, 6, 7, you have to feel for those kids, I think, because their draft may pass them by without really anything that's in their control in terms of their own status. So those kids are in a tough spot. And the kids, I mean, a lot of kids also went south, like OHL kids. I mean, Cole Sillinger is a Medicine Hat Tiger, but he played the full year in the USHL, and he helped his draft stock in a big way by doing that. And is probably going to be a top 15 pick instead of a top 30 pick as a result. So there's definitely stories of kids who benefited. And I think there's also a connection now among a lot of Canadian kids who are considering who are sort of debating going the college route, where they just trust that the USHL is going to sort of always be there in maybe a way that they don't trust the OHL. I've heard a lot of disappointment from agents and young sort of 14, 15 year old players coming up in terms of what happened in the OHL this year and how disappointed they were that the OHL never managed to get things on the rails. So there's some resentment that I think could linger, and the USHL pulling off the season that they did is probably going to help them in terms of recruiting players long term as well.
All right, let's do lightning round. Who's your favorite prospect from Pennsylvania?
From Pennsylvania.
I would have the great state of Pennsylvania.
Yeah. Can you give them some multiple choices?
No. Can I ring Karen McGuire on this?
No, you may not.
Best American in the draft.
I'm a big fan of Chaz Lucius. I keep hearing that he's going to go a little bit lower than I sort of have had him ranked. I think he's a legit sort of top 10 guy. I think Luke will be the first American picked. I think there are some real worries about Luke Hughes and what kind of player he's going to be long term. The fact that he's one of the youngest players in the draft certainly helps. The fact that he's now, according to himself, fully healthy from the foot injury helps. But he's not Quinn. They're very different players, and we'll see what path Luke takes. But it's Luke or Chaz for me for sure.
You're not a Matty Beniers fan.
Matt, I think his ceiling is going to result in him being that sort of very, very good NHL player. I think that's going to be, I probably shouldn't have even said that Luke was going to be the first American off the board, because Matt's probably going to end up in Seattle, would be my guess. Yeah. But
I keep seeing that.
Yeah, Matt, the thing with Matt is he's, I have no doubt he's going to be a really, really, really good NHL player. But if we're talking ceiling and the potential of that sort of stardom, I think Chaz has an opportunity to score 40 goals in the NHL if he really figures it all out. And I mean, Luke, with the way that he skates, is built to be, if he can sort of iron out some of his kinks, built to be that sort of classic modern defenseman that we all love now. So I think if either of those kids hit their ceiling, they will be better or more impactful players, maybe not better players, but more impactful players offensively than Matt Beniers will be.
Is there a U.S. player, like, in your evaluations that you kind of find that you're the outlier on? Like, are you higher on anybody in particular than you find other guys are?
Sasha Pastrzyjov is probably the one that comes to mind. Sasha had a season that would put him in line with the Cole Caulfields and the Alex Turcotts of the last, and the sort of the true upper echelon of the NTDP in terms of his underlying numbers, his data, how he has produced. So Sasha's a kid that I really, really like. I think he's got a chance to be a top six forward, and he doesn't necessarily go in that kind of range. He's probably going to go late first, early second, and I think he should go sort of in the teens, if you will.
Hmm. Last question for me. I think this draft, because of all the circumstances we talked about, there's going to be a player taken randomly that's maybe going to be the best player in the draft, right? Like, just because we don't have enough sample size, and it's hard enough as it is in a regular year. Do you have any predictions for some guy that you would say, you know what, this we haven't seen a ton of him, and that's going to hurt his draft stock, but there's such a high ceiling that this could be like the home run swing for a team?
Ooh, I don't know whether there's a kid who we haven't seen enough of. I do think there are kids who could sort of sneak in and be that kind of player. Cole Sillinger is the player who I always come to on this kind of a question, just because he's not widely regarded in that group of 9-10 players that every scout is in love with in this draft. He's probably going to go in that sort of 11 to 15 range. And I think Cole has a chance to be one of maybe the only two or three players in this draft who's kind of a 70 to 80 point guy in the NHL. Like, him and Kent Johnson are probably the two most purely gifted players in the draft in terms of offensive upside. And if Cole Sillinger becomes a 70 to 80 point player as a 11 to 15th overall pick, he's going to look like a top 5 to 10 pick in this draft long term. So Cole would probably be my answer. I think he has everything he needs. If he can get a little bit quicker, he's going to be a star.
You love Kent Johnson.
Cole Sillinger, the rare underrated player who has an NHL alum is a father. That never happens.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, Scott, we kept you too long. I know this is a busy time for you. So again, great job on the Sandy Hook story. I would encourage anyone listening to this to go read. Go to The Athletic. Go to the app, and you can read it right away. It's the top story
right
on the Athletic app today. And
deservedly so too.
Yeah, fantastic work, great read. And then I'm sure anything you got coming, you want to plug, Scott?
Just the draft coverage, the usual sort of look at all of the players. We've got a couple more features sort of on specific players. I've got a big one on Owen Power that's done that should be out in the coming days that I'm looking forward to sharing. So that kind of stuff just leading into the draft. And then draft day is just sort of the monotonous, here is what I think of every single player that I know anything about. And the kids that I don't know anything about, I'm not going to lie to you and pretend that I do. So that's kind of where I'm at. It's sort of heading into draft day.
Unlike Sean and I, who have very strong opinions about everybody taking,
even though I get tired by proxy reading Scott's work, because it's just like, oh my God. Secondhand exhaustion.
Well, hopefully the draft take the 50 hours that it felt like it took last year to actually unfold.
Fingers crossed for you, buddy. That was painful.
That second day was like a middle school swim meet.
Time warp. Absolutely. That was a track meet that lasts way too long.
Thanks, Scott. Yeah. We'll catch up after.
Thanks, guys.
That's a great segment there from Scott Wheeler. I love our draft coverage at The Athletic. This is not to just pump the tires of the company, because I'm a company man. We have so much coming around the draft with Corey Pronman and Scott Wheeler and all of our beat writers. I've seen the plans. I've seen what's on the line, what's at stake here for coverage. It's going to be massive. So, Scott, I hope he is able to get some rest between now and then, because there's still a lot of work to be done. But awesome conversation.
No matter what kind of work you do, how you communicate is key. Grammarly is your AI writing partner to help you communicate more effectively and efficiently so you can make a bigger impact at work. Whether you're sending emails or writing a Slack message, the last thing you want is a grammatical error. It just looks unprofessional. Just a little bit of help from Grammarly can make a big impact on your work day to day. 96% of Grammarly users report that Grammarly helps them craft more impactful writing. It works across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, tone suggestions help you navigate even the most difficult work conversations. Save time with one click and go from editing drafts in hours to seconds. 93% of professionals using Grammarly Premium report that it helps them get more work done. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Sign up and download for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
Welcome, Nikita Kucherov, to the pantheon of Stanley Cup celebrations. He joins, buddy, who have we seen over the years? Corey Crawford, legendary.
Alex Ovechkin. The best.
Maybe the best ever. You go back to the early 90s Penguins, as I often do, with Phil Bork and those guys, like, going ballistic with it. But Kucherov dialed it up yesterday, baby. The Lightning had their boat parade. Kucherov with, like, again, another what a run for him, man. I know there's people who are mad about it because the cup got dented, and that's always a big deal.
Is it bad that the cup got dented?
I don't care. I'm trying to be diplomatic. That doesn't matter. Like, look, we know what that thing's seen over the years, right? We've had all sorts of debauchery and all the cup ending up in odd places stories we've all heard them. So it's tough to get wound up over the dent in the top, big as it was. But man, I just love seeing it. This is what it's about. I think it's just fun, whether it's Kucherov or Patty Maroon or whoever, just to see these guys in action, and you can kind of sense just what a how fun the victory lap can be, and what a release it is for them this year. Because it really is. It's kind of like 2 years of stacked up drama and whatever else. You can finally do it the right way after 1 year in the bubble and all that stuff. Just a unreal performance. And I'm psyched to see what's next. We have we have months of these guys getting their respective days with it. It's going to be fun. They've set the bar quite high.
Are people still mad at Kuch, or are we all just on board with it now?
I saw people, cause I wrote off of Kucherov's press conference, and I truly try to not. Like, I'm cognizant of straw men, right? I don't want to make it seem like everybody's upset about something when it's just, you know, three crybabies. People are pissed. People are still pissed. I'm telling you, man, you look at it, whether it's disrespecting the cup or acting like a bad example for children, or, you know, Adam players wouldn't do this, blah, blah.
Wouldn't drink Bud Lights and... Yeah, great. Thanks.
Go talk to a hockey player if you think that this isn't directly in character. So I'm loving it. It's been a fun few days. I'm psyched to see what those freaks do with a cup over the next few months.
It's awesome. I wanted to, before we wrap up, I wanted to talk a little bit about Pekka Rinne. You know, Sean, I've loved Pekka Rinne for a long time.
As long as I've known you.
Yeah.
You bought stock early on Pekka Rinne, my friend.
I was in early with Pekka, and he announced his retirement today. 15 NHL seasons. He's got a Vezina trophy. Adam Vingan, our Predators beat writer, called him the greatest player in Predators history, which is, absolutely. He's going to have his number retired. He's going to go down as one of the best. And for me personally, it all ties to games I've been to and series I've covered. Mm-hmm. And watching him almost, I don't want to say single-handedly because it was a good Predators team, but beat the Red Wings for the first time. The Predators were like the little brother to the big brother Red Wings for a stretch of time in the postseason and in the regular season. And Pekka Rinne was so dominant in when this was against a really good Detroit team. Like this is close to peak Detroit powers. And Pekka went out and he looked unstoppable. Like just wasn't giving up rebounds, stopped everything. He's gigantic. And I remember thinking, boy, maybe that's when I just completely went all in on him. And being in that Predators dressing room after they won that series, and just seeing the how much he was just adored by teammates, it was just like, I love this guy. And he couldn't have been a better guy, and has always been really gracious with his time, and just a good dude. And so I wanted to recognize, because it's easy to get these retirements lost in the shuffle of busy offseason time. We have an expansion draft coming up, we have the NHL draft, we have free agency, we have trades. And so someone like Pekka, that can slide under the radar. And I just wanted to recognize the incredible career he had. He's one of those many goalies developed by Mitch Korn, who his impact on the game is huge. But Pekka Rinne was great for them, and what a career he's had. Unbelievable.
I'm glad we got to watch him pass the torch to UC Saros, too, because, not for nothing, that Pekka's career was in danger with the hip issues, with the, he had E. coli in his hip at one point. I mean, he dealt with some pretty gnarly stuff over the year, to the point where, I think there was a stretch where you said he would have been playing in 2021. Someone would have called you a liar. So for him to stick around, and be able to kind of usher that franchise into the next phase, it's a pretty cool thing. So happy trails to him.
That's amazing. Okay. A couple of things to highlight here at the end. I do want to, we mentioned Jeremy Rutherford in the Vladimir Tarasenko trade rumors. I think it's worth going and listening. He joined Ian Mendez and Haley Salvian, mm-hmm. who are not our rivals on this podcast.
No.
I think we've established that they're more a friend. Although Haley seemed mad. Did you have Dom on or something? She didn't like that we tried to commandeer Dom at some point.
I think she's just generally not a fan of my burgeoning alliance with Mr. Lustrician, yes.
I mean, the fact that you just effortlessly say his last name. Their show's great. And you should probably listen to the Friday show with Corey and Max, if for no other reason to listen to Max, who's our favorite, of course. Our best friend. In last week, we did a little Athletic Detroit reunion, and it's just, he's everything.
I saw that, man. I was jealous of all you guys, because it's been, I mean, my God, I haven't seen you in person in a year. Same goes for Max. So he's gonna be making a Pittsburgh trip here in a little bit. By the way. Yeah. Our buddy, we have a mutual friend, Mike Persak, who covers the Pirates for the Post-Gazette. Him and Max went to school together. He's a Grand Rapids boy also. So Max is going to be making a visit at some point soon. I'm psyched. My only fear is that he brings Corey with him.
Yeah, I think he's required to, but you have to bring your podcast partner. That's you and I, of course. You went on a family trip recently to the Grand Canyon.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. We're shopping for tandem bicycles for us to ride around together. Yes.
The last thing, if you're not a subscriber to The Athletic, of course, subscribe. But I want to encourage you to go into the comments section, and I'm pulling them up right now, of specifically this episode of this podcast, because this is where we interact best with our listeners. Last week, I asked for some guest ideas, and the first one was perfect. It was Phil Kessel, who I think, despite his, reluctance to do media, I would because Sean has they share a voice, it would be great.
is that actually true? Everyone says that, and it always bothers me a little bit. I don't think
you don't like that bit that Phil Kessel and you sound exactly.
I just like to think of myself as perfectly unique in every single way. So to hear that I share a voice with anybody is disarming.
Here's what I would say. Well, I mean, if we could get him on, and Rich and Aaron, if you're listening to this with the Coyotes, if you can set this up, we do want Phil. And even though he's going to say no, maybe you have to twist his arm. That we could settle that. Like, if for no other reason, we should have Phil Kessel on to put this. I think where it started, Sean, is because your imitation of him saying "Good one, Randy" was so good. It was a little too good, and that's what did it.
Should I just start doing impersonations on the podcast continually? I might turn that into a bit. Everyone loves them. Everyone loves impersonations. Everybody loves
them. Do they? Someone else suggested Chris Peters, who then went on Max and Corey Primon's podcast. So Chris is also dead to us. So that's out. Lou Nanny, a great suggestion from Thomas M. in the comments. We also are compiling our list of no-fly words. The words are phrases we can't use. We are no longer allowed to use galaxy brain. I'm not allowed to go, yeah, no, in the same phrase, which I apparently break all the time.
It's going to be tough for you.
It's going to be tough for me. Has suggested that we add pop to the no-fly list, only to be used if referring to soda. And so I'm trying to figure out if we can say, like, yeah, pop, which is the correct way to refer to any, like, soda or Coke.
I don't know if I've gone over this. I grew up saying pop and then switched to soda because I just got tired of getting ridiculed when I was in college. I'm a turncoat.
But what I don't know with Jonathan, and you might have to clarify it in the comments to this episode, Jonathan, if you don't like it in other references, like, hey, this is gonna pop. That's my guess. Is he only wants us to use pop if we're referring to soda?
That shouldn't be a problem. I don't know that we do that all that much.
I think this draft, this player is gonna pop. I don't think we do. It's
easy enough.
A request for John Forslund, which would be great. I think that would be really good.
I want to do a Kraken episode coming up here or have a Kraken guest at some point.
Yeah, we definitely have to, and that's in the works. A episode, and this may be a full 60 when we roll this back, but this is a great idea by Thomas N. on the 96 Team USA World Cup of Hockey that, you know, the Ron Wilson led, Lou Lamoriello put it together, incredible run. That's, you know, it's a great story. I think it's a great narrative. So the full 60 is going to come back in the fall as a narrative podcast. And I'm looking forward to listening to it, not doing all the work that goes into doing it because those are hard. But I think
that definitely deserves more than the two of us.
Deserves more than like us having Madonna
BSing.
On yeah. So Thomas M, I hear that, and that it's going to be that's a great idea, and I think it's going to happen based on your comment, and I love that idea.
Love it.
Let's see. Kevin R says he loves the podcast, even though he says we're number two behind Max and Corey. I think that's a plant. By clearly sent by the other.
What was his name?
Kevin R.
All right, I'm gonna do some recon, see how many Kevin R's Corey has in his circle.
Ryan Lambert request from Jimmy L.
If you never heard of him, never heard of him.
Sean has a podcast with Ryan Lambert. If you want Sean and Ryan, I think there's plenty of tape of that.
Yeah, it's us talking about chips and punk bands. So you can pay $4 a month to hear that.
Kevin W. says, if every episode you list the words or phrases that are banned, it sort of defeats the purpose.
It's a good point. Well, but we want people to know, though. We want people to know that we're responding to their concerns.
Yeah, Kevin, I disagree. As much as I love every commenter and each one is like a child to me, I would have to say we're not using the phrases throughout the podcast. We're just referencing them at the end so people know what's banned.
All commenters are tied as your third favorite child. We all know who's in fourth place.
Max? Oh, Max is number one. You know that. All right. Well, that's a wrap. Thanks again to Scott Wheeler for joining the podcast. Again, subscribe, read all his coverage. It's incredible. He's about to hit overdrive. It's great. Sean, great work again. Thank you.
You bet, buddy.
For listening to you, the listener, and have a great day.